You are listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. My name is Alex DeBoer.
I'm Max Newman.
I'm Armand Rana.
I'm Annie Reuter.
And I'm Milena Carrasco. It's Thursday, June 13th at 5:03 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
On today's show, we're covering a lot of local content. We're starting with an interview from News Collective comrade Milena, who interviewed a master's student named Shelby McPhee, who was racially profiled at a recent conference on June 6th at UBC.
June 2nd at UBC.
After that, we'll be hearing from outgoing director of Electoral Area A, which is here at UBC. He speaks with news comrade Armand about this Saturday's by-election.
We also have a piece from comrade Hannah Toms, who isn't in studio with us today. She interviewed school board trustees Jennifer Reddy and Louis Champatley on why they want to remove Cecil Rhodes from a local school.
Last, we have a special report from City Hall this Tuesday, when a new renter protection motion was passed. Max and Annie were there and spoke with renter advocates and later interviewed local reporter Jen St. Dennis, who explains the nuances of this motion and exactly what it means for renters in this city. But first, we have one headline to share. Vancouver's homelessness count was released yesterday, and it's the highest they've ever been since the count began in 2002. They only recently started the homelessness count annually in 2010, and this year, around 400 volunteers helped with the count. In total, the amount of people who identified as homeless was 2,223. This means it's a 2% increase from last year, which was 2,181. I think it's also important to note that this doesn't include people living on the street and people living in sheltered locations, such as emergency shelters, detox centers, and safe houses. Those aren't actually included under that number. This year, there were 1,609 classified as sheltered and 614 as unsheltered.
Right. And one thing to remember with this homeless count is that while the number of homeless people has gone up, the rate at which homelessness is growing compared to population has gone down a bit is something staff have pointed out, though this is still obviously shocking and really terrible news. And another thing that really stood out for me about this is that considering especially the recent report on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, that there was obviously, or not obviously, but you know, as it has been in previous years, there was a disproportionate amount of Indigenous people represented on this homeless count. And especially for women, it was, I believe, 53% of the women in this count were Indigenous. So, you know, the impacts of colonialism are definitely a big part of this. But thanks for sharing that headline with us, Milena. We wanted to start out the show with your interview with master student Shelby McPhee, who was here presenting at a conference on June 2nd. Can you just tell us a little bit more about what happened before we go to that story?
Yeah, for sure. So a student named Shelby McPhee, as you mentioned, from Acadia University, Nova Scotia, who was attending a conference on June 2nd put on by the Federation of Humanities and Social Sciences on the UBC campus on June 2nd, earlier this month. He was racially profiled and wrongfully accused of stealing a laptop.
Yep. All right. So we are going to go to this piece now, and then we'll chat a little bit about it after.
So, hey, thank you so much for joining us on CITR 101.9 FM.
Thank you, Milena. I'm really appreciative of being here with you today, and I'm grateful for the invitation to share my story and have this kind of discussion with you.
On Monday, June 9th, I called the individual at the center of an incident of racial profiling and harassment on UBC's campus.
Sure. So my name is Shelby McPhee. Graduated last year with my bachelor's degree in political science from Acadia University in Nova Scotia, East Coast. I'm think that is the East Coast, right?
Yeah.
That is the East Coast.
Yeah, it is.
I doubted myself there for a while.
Earlier this month, Shelby was invited to UBC by the Black Canadian Students Association to present at Congress, a conference held by the Canadian Federation for the Humanities and Social Sciences.
And then it would have been my first time on beautiful, very, very beautiful campus, UBC campus. And so I was excited to be there, and I was just astounded by the beauty of the school. And so I came to present, and, you know, as they say, the rest is history from there.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
The Canadian Federation for the Humanities and Social Sciences is an organization that, according to their website, promotes research and teaching for the advancement of an inclusive, democratic, and prosperous society. It represents over 90,000 grad students and researchers across Canada. Once a year, this federation holds a huge academic gathering.
Congress. The Congress is the event, the scholarly event that the federation puts on. People get to come, share their research, share their scholarly research, you know, glean from other scholars, learn from other scholars. You know, it's just, it's a week of, you know, intellectual masturbation that way.
Shelby was at the Congress to present his thesis.
Yes, I was presenting my research on my thesis that I'm working on right now. My thesis, actually, looks at the role white women played in colonialism. That's the interesting part of this entire twist, right?
Wow.
Is that my thesis looks at the white woman's role in colonialism. They played a particular kind of role in managing, mm-hmm. not necessarily policing at the time, but managing and controlling the body of the native, or managing and controlling the body in the space that the marginalized person occupied, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what my thesis looks at. And then, lo and behold, this thing, right, where my body, my marginalized body, is managed in UBC, at UBC. So that's what I was presenting on, the role in which women played in, one, colonialism, the role in which marginalized women played in the decolonization agenda.
Wow. Could you describe to me what happened on Sunday at the conference? You were there, ready to present your thesis on this. How did everything pan out?
Yeah, for sure. So I was excited to present, and so that Sunday I had just come in, I just got off of a flight. I flew through the night to get to BC because of the time difference and all of that. So I just arrived in Vancouver.
Shelby ended up meeting a colleague on the plane, and the two of them hit it off and went to campus early to register.
9:10. So we had a lot of time to play with, and so we got on the campus, we registered, and we decided we're going to work on putting our presentation together. And so we spent some time putting our presentation together, and then we got up to go to lunch. UBC has all these amazing food places, the deli on campus. It was amazing. And then from there, we went to look at the rooms that we were going to be presenting in. As we were leaving the campus, we realized that the two people or two individuals that had been sitting at the table that we were at earlier that day when we were polishing off our research presentations were speaking to one another. And well, the lady that was at the time was on her phone saying that the two gentlemen that were sitting next to us earlier are passing us now. And we knew that she was speaking about us because we recognized them from
the It started table. To look like the couple was taking a picture of Shelby and his friend. Then the couple started to follow them. Eventually, the man hid after they had made eye contact, and then they headed for the volunteer booth.
And so what happened was we went back, or we dashed into the volunteer booth, and we went over there to the volunteer booth, and we asked, you know, what's the problem? Why are you, it looks like you're following us. And so he said, there's no problem. He looked at my friend, and he says, I recognize you from earlier today, but I don't recognize you. And he's talking to me, and he says, are you registered with this conference? And so it's important to remember that my friend is white, I'm black. I'm the only one that has our registration material in our hands. He has his registration material in his bag. And this gentleman is asking me, are you registered for this conference? And so in my defense, I say, well, it's none of your business if I'm registered or not. You are not the police. You are not campus security. But furthermore, why are you asking me if I'm registered? You should be asking him, who's not wearing anything. At this moment, I knew what this was because he was asking me if I was registered, and he wasn't asking my white friend if he was registered. And so that's the reason why I replied the way I reply. And then he said, well, we just want to know because my laptop was stolen. And so I said, are you accusing me of stealing your laptop? His wife or his friend or whoever this white woman comes over, and she says, you know, we don't recognize you. Are you registered for this conference? That's none of your concern. If I'm registered, why are you asking me? You should be asking him. And I said, you know, she said, well, you know, the RCMP is on their way because our laptop was stolen and they're going to come and sort this out right now.
Campus security was called, but they wouldn't respond. And instead, the RCMP arrived to detain Shelby.
To softly detain me. They didn't handcuff me or hold me, but they stood on the side of me as if to say, you know, don't move. And it's very important to remember that if I had run, it would have looked like some kind of admission of guilt. So I stayed. The RCMP came. The RCMP realized that the claims were groundless, and so, you know, they let me go. But what's also interesting to remember here and to point out is that the Federation's representative came down, and when she came down, she spoke first to accusers, and she never spoke to me. She allowed the white woman and the white man to control the narrative, as per the usual, and she never came to me until the RCMP had in some way exonerated me as if I was a criminal.
In these progressive spaces, like these so-called progressive spaces, like these acts are still happening. And so one of the questions I wanted to ask you was how you think that in the realm of humanities and social sciences, like we can begin practicing these papers we write on the political body or on the immigrant body, on the black body, the Chilean body, or the Latina body. Like, I don't know, like how do we make sure that things like this don't happen again? But like, how do we navigate that in academia, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask.
I think the first thing that we have to remember and the first thing that we as academics have to agree on is that racism is not obsolete in academic spaces. Racism, racial profiling, discrimination, these kinds of things are not obsolete in academic spaces. There is a preponderance of these actions in these spaces, right? That people are looked at and viewed differently and read differently every single day in academic environments, right? From the way in which we choose which scholarship matters to the way in which we credit knowledge, right? There is racial discrimination every single day in academia. That's the first thing that we have to understand. That's the first thing that we have to acknowledge before we begin unpacking and doing the work of decolonizing academic spaces, right? All of this, I think, is a part of a larger or more broader context of what's happening or what needs to be happening at a national level in Canada, right? That understanding, one, that these things aren't obsolete in academic spaces, that's the first thing. The second thing I think that we need to do, and I don't know if this makes sense, but the second thing I think we need to do is, you know, just be open to different kinds of knowledge, be open to different kinds of scholarship. You know, I am doing a paper now that looks at when people begin to view their position as the norm, that's problematic. When you begin to view what you do, say, and how you act as the norm, that's problematic. That means that you are not open to different kinds of understandings, different kinds of readings, different kinds of ontologies and different ways of being and different ways of living. And that's the thing with scholars, right? A lot of scholars aren't open to those different kinds of things.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Could I ask what the current status is between you and the Federation and UBC?
UBC has given me one plain statement that they don't condone I've alleged a racial profiling. That boils my blood every single time I hear that word, that I'm alleging this. This is nothing that I'm alleging. I have people that are...
The statement. which uses the word alleged to describe the racial profiling and harassment Shelby experienced, was released on June 5th. It received a lot of backlash, including from UBC's very own Black Students Union. It states that UBC Human Resources is supporting the Federation in its investigation of this incident. But in terms of Shelby and the Federation...
There is a kind of a standoff now between us because I am calling particularly for them to release the names of my accusers and force my accusers, one, to be... to face the music, right? They broke the code of conduct, so they should be, therefore, be expelled and face the consequences. Second, they need to begin to do the work of reconciliation with me.
Shelby isn't certain why the Federation won't release the names of his accusers, though he has his suspicions.
What I do know is that it's not a good look for the Federation. Mm-hmm. It's really not a good look for the Federation. It makes the Federation seem that they're more interested in their donors and upholding the whiteness and white supremacy in the organization rather than working to dismantle this whiteness and this white supremacy and create an equal playing field for all and ensure that there is safe, discrimination-free environments for people of color, for marginalized communities, and for people that dwell at the margins of life. Mm-hmm. That's where we are now with the Federation.
As of the publication of this piece, Shelby still has not been given the names of his accusers from the Federation. UBC did, however, release a revised apology on Wednesday, June 12th. It starts with the line, "We made a mistake." It goes on to say that the language used in the original statement only made a bad situation worse. The new apology states that Shelby was subjected to anti-Black racism, racial profiling, and harassment. It does not use the word alleged. Do you think that there's any next steps that you believe Congress can address in the following Congress or for 2020?
I do. I think that the Congress should work toward putting BCSA as one of the leading organizations next year in the Federation to ensure that those kinds of conversations are happening, right? How do we work against anti-Black racism and racial violence, racial discrimination in our academic spaces, in our universities, and in our research, in our scholarly research. I think that the Federation needs to build a better relationship with the association because the association is the leading association that brings the coloredness, if I can say that, to the fore, to the organization, right? That the BCSA does that work. They bring the most Black people to the Federation. Without the BCSA, the Federation would be whitewashed and sprinkled with other communities. They're like a dash of them. But the BCSA does the work of bringing bringing Black and brown people to the Congress. And I think that the Federation needs to build a better relationship with the BCSA and put the BCSA at the fore in the next Congress to ensure that those kinds of complicated conversations are happening.
Shelby, once again, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for that, Milena. That was wonderful. Up next, we have some news from Vancouver's school board. Vancouver school board trustees Jennifer Reddy, Vancouver School Board Trustee Singular, Jennifer Reddy, submitted a motion for consideration at a school board committee meeting, which will take place next week. This motion is to immediately remove a sign commemorating Cecil Rhodes. Cecil was a leader in the establishment of institutionalized racism against Black people in Southern Africa. News Collective member Hannah Tom spoke with Reddy, as well as school board trustee Lois Chan Pedley, about the importance of removing this sign. And we should mention that though this motion hasn't yet been voted on, the sign has actually been covered up at the school in question. So let's take a listen to Hannah's piece.
If the name Cecil Rhodes is familiar to you, you may know him as a 19th century British businessman and politician who believed that white people are, quote, a supreme race, and that Black people, quote, a subject race in a state of barbarism. who believed staunchly in settler colonialism and British imperialism and expanded Britain's colonial territory in southern Africa, causing the deaths of thousands of Native Africans in the process, who passed laws to disenfranchise Native Africans and force them off their land, whose ideology and policies of white supremacy were admired by Hitler himself. You may also know him as the namesake of Rhodes University in South Africa, the Rhodes Scholarship at Oxford University, and countless other universities and scholarships, roads and public places, and monuments across the Commonwealth. This includes a monument right here in Vancouver. On the playground of Lake Holby Lang in Vancouver's Shaughnessy neighborhood, there sits a plaque that reads Cecil Rhodes School, which was the school's name from 1910 to 1977. At a meeting of the Vancouver School Board on June 10th, Trustee Jennifer Reddy put forward a motion to remove this plaque and any other references to Rhodes from Lake Holby Lang school property. I spoke with Reddy on the phone yesterday to hear her take on the importance of her motion being passed. She would like to remind listeners that she is speaking for herself as an individual and not on behalf of Vancouver's school board.
Cecil Rhodes represents an international face of colonialism and imperialism and systemic racism. And so as I dug a little deeper and read further into some of his quotes and principles and philosophies, I became even more concerned that this name is not only recognized in our district, but that it's upheld deliberately on school property. Systemically discriminatory and racist procedures and policies were things that he was known for and sought after as a leader at that point in time. For me, like when I think about my role in education as a leader, like I want to make sure that where I'm leading from is from a place of values. And so when I see something like that in my way, and when I see what that must mean or not mean for children that see it every day in their playground, or the parents who have noticed it and have taken concern with it, I feel like that's an obvious way to respond, is to reflect the response happening internationally as well.
Reddy is referring to recent protest movements happening around the world that call for a removal of monuments honoring Rhodes or the renaming of places and institutions named in his honor. The most notable of these movements has been #RhodesMustFall, a student campaign at the University of Cape Town that succeeded in having the statue of Rhodes on their campus taken down. I asked Reddy what had prompted her to forward her motion at Monday's VSB meeting.
The role of a trustee really is to hear and represent the community. We're elected by individuals to represent what the community wants to see in terms of education, but also values based leadership. And so for me, it was just kind of a part of the daily role, which is when people bring things to your attention, you evaluate them and you ask questions, you investigate, and then bring something forward. For me, yeah, it was responding to what parents have brought forward and what community members have also highlighted as a significant opportunity for us to action our commitment to both reconciliation and anti-Black racism, of which we do constantly and in a very values-based way. So we've had motions put forward on issues of reconciliation and our stance on anti-Black racism. So this feels like an obvious complement to that.
A recent article in Daily Hive quoted Stephanie Allen, the director over at Hogan's Alley Society, that Black children and their families are repeatedly bringing forward the exclusion and discrimination they feel in the VSB. I asked Reddy to share her observations on anti-Black exclusion and discrimination within the Vancouver school system.
So I'm connected with the community in multiple ways. So Black, Indigenous people of color communities, young people, youth, educators in our community. So it's not the first time I'm hearing about anti-Black racism as something that is very pervasive, both in our city, in our schools, but also Canada and arguably the world at large. And so it hasn't been like a brand new topic for me. So I'll say that the Tai'i article prompted me to make a deliberate connection between these dots and find out how I could be of assistance to the community.
She's talking about an article published in the Tai'i on June 6th entitled Why One School Keeps a Special Place for a Father of Apartheid, referring, of course, to Lake Holby Lang and its plaque. I asked Reddy whether the Cecil Rhodes plaque is causing discomfort and concern uniquely among Black students at Lake Holby Lang and their families.
It's a part of a whole bunch of systemic opportunities to address exclusion and opportunities to build belonging. So when we talk about things like Cecil Rhodes with the community, it's obvious that this is one of the instances where we have an opportunity to improve belonging. So absolutely, but also it's coming from parent advisory councils. It's coming from the general community, so I wouldn't say it's like X community's issue or Y community's issue, but what I'm enjoying about this process is that I'm having really fruitful conversations with a lot of different people, parents who are concerned, educators who are concerned about working in a place like this, and young students who are like, what is that? I don't know what that sign means. I just use it for a goalpost at school. So it's caused a lot of concern and conversation among people. It's not just an issue that affects people of color or black people, for sure, but in particular, it is an issue that many people are bringing forward to recognize that creating this sense of belonging is all of our responsibilities.
I then asked Reddy to predict how her motion will be received among the other VSB trustees when the time comes to vote on it.
Yeah, I think really positively. I mean, we have made a strong unanimous stance on anti-Black racism in our district. And at the same time, I mean, we have things like UN standards on place naming that are adhering to place name values and well-being and belonging. We also speak a lot about equity and safety, student safety. So for sure, if something like this creates discomfort or lack of safety or lack of well-being, doesn't align with our values, I think it's going to be a really important discussion and one that will bring us together.
But the motion may not be received so positively by one of Reddy's fellow VSB trustees, Lois Chan Pedley. Trustee Pedley has tweeted, in regard to the potential removal of Cecil Rhodes' plaque, that she is worried about erasure and pretending our mistakes didn't happen. I phoned her to find out more on her stance.
I think the plaque in question, as it stands, without any context and explanation, is very problematic. What I'm worried about is that if we're removing all traces of it and his name, et cetera, it's equivalent kind of to sweeping it all under the rug. There's a famous quote by George Santayana, those who don't remember the past are condemned to repeat it. This is a chance for the district to own the mistakes it's made and make this into a valuable learning moment, do something coherent, not just for now, but for future generations. It appears as though we're honoring a racist person without context. It's a plaque with a famous person's name on it, you know, without explaining that this is a problematic person in history and explaining why the school was renamed and why this is being kept for so-called heritage reasons. It's problematic on its own.
I asked Chan Pedley what actions she thinks should be taken at Lake Colby Lang to counteract Rhodes' legacy, while also reminding the community of our city's past mistakes in honoring him.
What I really like is for the community, the school community, the parent community, the students to come together and find a way that works for them and make it into really a learning moment so that we know what the impacts of this history, how it impacts us today, what we're doing as a whole community to face this moving forward.
Finally, I asked her if the Cecil Rhodes plaque belongs on Lake Colby Lang's property or whether it's time to remove it.
Again, I think that's something that we have to engage the community to figure out what's right for them. Maybe there isn't a way to keep it there. Maybe there is. I don't know what can be added to it or subtracted from it. I'd have to hear more from, I mean, both the community and staff about the regulations around why and how it's put there too. So it's complex.
Reddy, Chan Pedley, and their fellow VSB trustees will be discussing Reddy's motion at a meeting on the 19th and then voting on whether to remove Rhodes' plaque from Lake Colby Lang on the 24th.
Ya ni wedo haline.
All right, I'm gonna do it wrong. I'm about to spit in this mic like freestyle elfin, you know?
Okay. Wait, hold on. Does it make sense?
No, but who cares? All right, let's go. Finally, we. You're not even gonna last. Hey. Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival, fountain, just back from France. Montreal. What the
Victoria's Pretty Good Not Bad Festival. Yeah. Fountain's okay, just back from France. What are you even saying here? Oh, you're trying to say these are the things featured in this one. You should probably specify that, because even a fucking elf couldn't understand that, okay?
Think you can do better than an elf? At CITR, we want to have a variety of voices on the air. Want to write scripts? Do some voice acting? Broadcast your creativity? Volunteer with the CITR Production Department. No experience? We can also train you in everything required. Send an email to psas@citr.ca to learn more. And don't wait to get your voice on the air.
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smoke you every day.
Pick up a copy around Vancouver or f*** with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
Let's see here. World of Warfare, God. Ugh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Ugh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
Isn't there anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
Everybody. And we're back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9. Thanks so much for joining us. We just heard the story of an academic who was racially profiled at a conference at UBC on June 2nd. We also heard from school board trustees Jennifer Reddy and Louis Chan-Pedley, who discussed a motion on removing a Cecil Rhodes plaque at a Vancouver school.
Yeah.
We are now moving on to a by-election happening right here at UBC this weekend.
This Saturday, June 15th, voters in parts of Metro Vancouver will have the opportunity to cast their ballot in a by-election for the director of Electoral Area A. Armand, you're the expert here. What constitutes Electoral Area A?
Good question. So Electoral Area A is basically all areas in Metro Vancouver that are not incorporated into a municipality.
Ooh.
This means the UBC, the University Endowment Lands, Barnston Island, Howe Sound communities, including Passage and Boyer Islands, as well as Pitt Lake and Indian Arm communities. And in the 2016 census, the population of Electoral Area A was around 16,000, but 98% of that lived in the UBC Peninsula.
Okay.
You can also check out a piece we did for Seeking Office featuring an interview by Justin McElroy on October 4th. It was reported on by Samuel Jones and by yourself, Alex DeBoer. The episode takes a really deep dive into UBC and the endowment lands and their position within Metro Vancouver.
Yeah, Justin McElroy is definitely an expert. So, yeah.
Yeah, so to learn more about the upcoming election and the role of electoral area director, we caught up with the outgoing director, Mike Feely. Let's hear what he had to say.
Here we go.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Sure, I'm happy to talk.
So to start off, could you tell us a bit about yourself and what your role is as alternate director?
Well, I'm actually the director. I've been the director.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Sure, I'm happy to talk.
So to start off, could you tell us a bit about yourself and what your role is as alternate director?
Well, I'm actually the director. I've been the director since February when the director at that time resigned. I was his alternate, which I took on in November. I'm a BC professor of computer science. I've lived on campus for 23 years since I moved to Vancouver. My kids were raised on campus. And I have a vested interest in seeing our community prosper. I think this is one of the best places to live on Earth.
Explain a bit more for our listeners. What is the job of the director? Like, what kind of things do they do on a day-to-day basis for the electoral area?
Right. So first of all, there's this strange thing called the Electoral Area A. So this is all of the unincorporated areas in the Vancouver Regional District. Other regional districts throughout the province have many electoral areas. We only have one because most of the region is incorporated. So it includes, you know, the things you would expect, you know, Indian Arm, House Sound, Barnston Island, various places like this. And then sort of unusually, this area that's not rural at all, the Point Grey Peninsula. So in that piece is, you know, the campus, university neighborhoods, and the UEL, which is everyone that's living on freehold land west of Blanca. You know, the director for the electoral area is the only director for Metro Vancouver who's elected. All of the rest of them are appointed by the councils. So the director serves two roles. There's two different major committees that the director's on and all these people are on. So one is the Metro Vancouver Regional Government, and the other is the TransLink Mayor's Council for Transportation. So the Metro Regional Government, that board consists of, I think it's 40 representatives who are councillors or mayors. There's 21 municipalities, there's the Tawasin First Nations, and there's Electoral Area A. The responsibilities of the regional government are sort of two main things. One is service delivery, so things like regional parks, water, sewage, solid waste. Things that maybe don't sound so exciting, but are actually quite important. Dealing with climate change, dealing with, you know, our aspirations, at least mine, and I think most of the region to get to a zero waste position, so we're not putting things in garbage into the landfill. So that's one part of it, and then the other part is regional planning. So this is how the region decides together where density will go. The anticipation is that, well, we've been adding 35,000 people a year to the region. So if you project that out over the next 30 years, that's a million new people. And so it's very important that there's a plan for this region to grow sensibly so that it's as wonderful in 30 years from now as it is now. Plus, we have huge regional issues to address. Climate change, obviously, is one, and another one is affordability. And so there's a certain sort of planning role that working with each of the local municipalities that the Metro government has. And the electoral area director is, you know, sits at that table. It's, you know, our voice in those regional planning decisions. So the other thing is the mayor's council. So this is like particularly important to us on campus here because this is the body that will make that makes decisions on where transit dollars get invested.
Yeah, so one second. I just want to give our listeners some context. In 2012, the former director, Maria Harris, became a member of the Mayor's Council on Regional Transportation. And that's what you're talking about. That
is what I'm talking about, exactly, right.
So why is it important that the Electoral Area A director is a member of this Regional Transport Council?
Well, it was really a mistake that we weren't there. This body makes the investment decisions for regional transportation. So TransLink sort of is a complicated governance structure. There's a TransLink board that makes the operational decisions. The CEO of TransLink reports to that board. And then there is the mayor's council that makes the investment decisions. So decisions like, well, when rapid transit comes to UBC, it'll use SkyTrain technology. That was a decision that was made by the mayor's council. Decisions about what the, you know, regional priorities are going to be with respect to, you know, where do the B-lines go, where do the SkyTrain goes, where does the light rail go, and things like this. It's very important that we're there so that our perspectives are understood. We're the only area that isn't represented by municipal government. And so this is our only voice in these regional decision-making process.
On that last point, so, you know, Electoral District A is somewhat different. It spans a wide geographical region, one with presumably varied interests and needs. With the by-election coming up, what key issues have been raised by candidates in an attempt to unify the interests of the constituents?
Well, I think one of the key things that everybody's talked about that the director is going to have influence in, and this is going to be a long-term process, is SkyTrain. It's common that around mass transit corridors and stations that there's densification, but there's a decrease in affordability. So the things that get built around transit hubs tend to be, by default, more expensive homes. These are places that people are less likely to use transit, actually. And so that there's a whole set of really interesting issues around TransLink. And the candidates have all mentioned various different aspects of trying to deal with this. I think all the candidates also have mentioned affordability. It's a super difficult problem. It's one that we face in a particular way on campus. Students have great difficulty finding affordable places to live on campus or elsewhere. You know, as a professor, I want the students who want to live on campus to be here. And the university is doing things. There's a sort of a limited amount that the regional government can do. But, you know, I mentioned their role is this long-term planning, thinking about strategies and priorities for producing affordable housing and dealing with, you know, other levels of government, you know, in the meantime, before SkyTrain, because it's not going to come for quite a while, improving bus service, getting more B-lines, as is happening, getting priority signaling so the B-line to campus and off campus faster. You know, we're surrounded by this incredibly beautiful park that's under stress in certain ways, including erosion of the cliffs along Lake Beach, and some candidates have mentioned those issues as well. Most people also mentioned the broad question of, probably know that UBC reports directly to the provincial government for things like land use planning permission.
So on the flip side, you know, there's this huge, like 90-something percent of the population and electoral area lives in the kind of the UBC Peninsula. And then you have these people distributed across more rural areas. What are some of the challenges you have faced while governing such a diverse region?
Well, it's challenging. I've only been in the position for a short time, and I'm not running in the by-election, as you know. And I also had a full-time job when I took it on, so I asked for a light load. I was only on one committee, and really I was just trying to provide some continuity until the by-election. I am aware, I know Maria Hera, who was the director for a long time. I know that she worked very hard to go out into those other areas, get to know the people there. I think if you talk to them, they know who she is, and they really appreciate the effort she put into to understanding their issues, because while they're few in number, they also have no one else to represent them in the regional government. They're not in the city. And so things like fire protection and the way that they're impacted by, you know, sewage lines and water and garbage collection and a whole variety of things that, you know, you take for granted when you're in a city. They only, you know, the only government entity, local government entity they have is Metro Vancouver through the director. So it's super important that the director goes out and pays attention to those things. All of the candidates at the debate, all committed to doing that. It's not easy. It's geographically dispersed over the entire regional district. It's easy to see the issues for the people living on the peninsula.
You know, Metro Vancouver acts as the local, as you mentioned, the local government for electoral area A. However, certain services are provided by other agencies, including the province, local health authorities, and local school district. What are some of the challenges that can arise for residents who have the services covered by multiple jurisdictions, and in what ways should this be considered when they go to the polls this Saturday?
It's a good question, and the answer depends upon actually where you live. I know best the people that are living on University Neighborhoods Association area, the residents on campus. And as you say, we get the roads on campus here are by and large administered by the BC Ministry of Transportation and Infrastructure. We get fire services from the city of Vancouver that we're being dramatically overcharged for by the provincial government. We get police services from the RCMP, which we also pay for through our taxes. The planning and zoning are through the university in its relationship with the province in the land use plan. And then we have all the municipal services like community centers and so on that are provided by the UNA. We get our water through the UEL to the university to us. So, you know, it is really complicated. One of the most important things when voting, and I hope people do go out and vote, is to think not so much about how the regional district impacts us, because it does, but, you know, another part of this, which is how we can influence the region. And it's an extremely important region in the world, and I think I want, and I think many people who live here want, to see Vancouver as a region be a leader in addressing the problems of the 21st century. You know, things like growth, finding affordable places for people to live, being carbon free, and dealing with the impacts of climate change. And I want to see Vancouver be a leader in that. And the way that we can do that is by voting for somebody as our voice in the regional government who will represent those values and will argue, work with the other municipal leaders to craft the solutions that we want. And so we do our best to pick the person who we think is going to be our the best representative in those regional issues.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us, Director Mike Feely.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for your efforts to help people understand the election and get people to come out and vote. And they can vote on Saturday at the Westbrook Community Center.
Awesome. Thanks. So. Thanks for listening, everyone. And thanks so much to Director Mike Feely for giving us a better idea of what's going on in this crazy electoral area A.
It's crazy.
Yeah. So if you're a side in, if you're a side at UBC, the UEL, Barnston Island, House Sound communities, including Passage and Boyer Islands, or Indian Arm Pitt Lake communities, make sure you get out to vote on Saturday, June 15th. Further information concerning where to vote, what type of ID to bring, and the platforms of the candidates can be found at metrovancouver.org/board/elections/voting.
Did everyone write that down?
You better.
Just honestly Google it, people. Come on.
And editing... production and research was conducted by myself and Andy Laidman. Up next, we turn to our favorite topic here at the News Collective. Housing!
Okay. Thanks, Armand. So, housing was on the table again this week at Vancouver City Council. On Tuesday, Council unanimously passed several measures which are designed to improve renter protections. And after that, Mayor Kennedy Stewart tweeted calling the measures Canada's broadest and most comprehensive series of protections for renters.
Yeah, but as reporter Jansen Dennis points out, there's a big difference between the new financial compensation awarded to tenants who are demo-evicted versus reno-evicted. So let's have a listen.
Okay, so our first report is the actions to increase renter protection and amendments to the renter tenant relocation and protection policy.
On Tuesday, June 11th, myself, Max Newman, and Annie Rutter went to City Hall to attend council. It was packed with tenants and lobbyists as council discussed staff report RR1, actions to increase renter protection and amendments to tenant relocation protection and policy.
COPE Councillor Jean Swanson originally tabled the motion in December, and a subsequent staff report was done and passed unanimously on Tuesday. Some of the key measures include better compensation for some displaced tenants, more assistance finding permanent housing for displaced tenants that face housing barriers, and better transparency and communication between renters and landlords.
A lot of this will happen through amendments to the city's Tenant Relocation and Protection Plan and getting authority from the BC Residential Tenancy Act.
But it's not as clear-cut as that.
Hi, Jen. This is Annie calling from CITR.
Star Vancouver reporter Jen St. Dennis covers city politics and housing. We reached her on the phone on Wednesday, and she broke down the new policy for us, including a major distinction between compensation models for tenants facing rent eviction versus demo eviction.
Thanks for speaking with us today, Jen. You've covered rentals and affordability for the Star Vancouver and have written about the specific measures that passed in council on Tuesday. Can you give us a brief summary of the motion that passed on Tuesday?
Sure. So this was a report from staff. It was a pretty comprehensive policy, and it aimed to kind of improve an existing policy, the tenant relocation policy, that basically gives renters the right to several months of compensation, depending on how long they've lived in a building, if their landlord is redeveloping the building. So if it's an older apartment building and they've gotten permission to maybe tear it down and build something newer, or their renovations are so massive that it's a redevelopment permit situation. So the tenant relocation plan policy was already there. And so what city staff proposed and what council voted for was to increase the compensation quite a bit. So I think for what ended up happening, if you've lived in your unit for 40 years, you get 24 months compensation. So it kind of like steps up depending on how many years you've lived in your building. So that was quite an improvement on what they had before.
So it looks like on the surface, Jen, this motion doubles the compensation rent-evicted tenants are able to receive. But the article that you wrote yesterday says that the doubled compensation, quote, only applies to buildings where owners have applied for a development permit. It does not apply when the owner has obtained a building permit to renovate. So can you clarify the distinction between these two cases?
Yeah, and I think this is where people are kind of maybe getting the wrong impression about what this motion does. I think a lot of tenants who have seen their building change hands and know their owner might be about to renovate and try to evict them think, oh, great, now I'm protected. But for most rent evictions, where the owner is renovating and using that as an excuse to evict, they're just getting a building permit. They're just getting a permit to replace the windows or do repiping. You don't need a development permit for that. You just need a building permit. And, you know, tenants can go through this the lengthy provincial residential tenancy branch system and fight the eviction, but it's quite a stressful process. So this policy...
While we were at City Hall, we met Milo Groundwater and Danny Beckett, two tenants going through a stressful arbitration process in the face of a dem eviction.
We live in a building in Hastings Sunrise that's getting demolished, and we've been fighting it with the VTU, and we have a hearing next week about it. We actually got an eviction notice like the day after Christmas, the first eviction notice, and we discovered that they didn't have any permits or any rights to be evicting yet. Like, you just like don't know the legal things behind it all, so it's just like this just like goose chase where we're just like going through all of these things trying to figure out what their real reasons are legally to be able to evict us. And it's taking so much back and forth and energy. And another tenant who's not here today is like doing basically full-time work on this for all of us in the building. And he's just like getting very stressed out and having to talk to different people.
So what's the significance of this distinction?
I think the significance is that for a lot of tenants, you know, this is a significant protection for tenants who are under the threat of demo eviction. So that's when your building is actually going to get torn down and you have to move because that's just the way it is. You know, the city's given the developer permission to do that. So that is significant. They're going to get more money. They're going to get more help relocating now. But a lot of tenants are in a situation where their landlord is, you know, attempting to evict them because they just want to renovate the apartment, basically, so that they can increase the rates. And we've seen a big increase in this behavior as apartment buildings values have risen and as rents have risen, there's an increasing gap between what long-time tenants are paying and what new tenants are paying. And so there's this increased profit motivation for landlords to try to use any kind of way they can to evict long-time tenants. I think a lot of people in Vancouver, they are affected by just common garden variety rent eviction, and they are not going to be... they're not going to really get any more protections under this new policy.
There's like zero level of trust between us and our landlord. We're really paranoid. And we're lucky to have the VTU, but I think in general there's like no real support for tenants.
Milo and Danny are facing demo eviction, which would mean they benefit from the new compensation policy. But it's still challenging to find a new place within the same low price point.
I think all people want is like to just know what the possibilities are for like living in the same bracket as they have been.
So far, Milo is not convinced the landlord will fulfill the obligations under the city's tenant relocation policy.
Basically, right now, like the situation with our hearing and everything is that they have about a month to fill their TRP. And that is essentially impossible for them to do with the rental market right now. Because like, unless they're just finding us places that are incredibly more expensive. But I know that one option for everybody has to be within 10%, and that's going to be so difficult because we have like units that are two people and they're both moving separately.
So how much farther does this report actually advance the protection and enhance the rights of tenants facing rent evictions or dem evictions, which is what COPE Councillor Jean Swanson was hoping to address when she first tabled the motion?
Yeah, I think it's quite different than what tenants who were at that initial motion when Jean Swanson put it forward in November, December, they were really cheering it when it was passed because they were under the impression it was going to ban rent evictions. You know, the city is putting in some things that will help people access their rights under the provincial system. Like they're putting in this renter's office, which renters can go to and get services and hook up with advocates and help them negotiate the residential tenancy board arbitration system. But I think that, you know, when I contrast that with what New Westminster and Port Coquitlam have done, where they have these bylaws that use their own business licensing power to say to landlords, like, you can't do this, you can't evict tenants just to renovate, and we have a bylaw that's going to say that you can't do that or we're going to fine you, that actually prevents, should go some way towards preventing the eviction attempt in the first place, whereas what Vancouver has done is said, well, we'll help you go through the provincial system, but it's still very onerous and it's very stressful for some tenants, especially if they're older or more vulnerable, to go through this arbitration system that's very legal, and they're often very, very stressed out by it and are worried that if they don't win their arbitration case, that they could be evicted, you know, within, in some cases, they could be evicted within a few weeks, in one case that I know of.
Following Tuesday's vote, Mayor Kennedy Stewart tweeted the statement, quote, "I am so proud that the City of Vancouver Council unanimously adopted Canada's broadest and most comprehensive series of protections for renters." What are your thoughts on that?
So I personally think that this is leaving a bit of a, I think it's confusing people. I think that it's sort of leaving the impression that everyone is protected. I don't want to diminish the policy itself. The policy itself is very significant. These are, you know, like they've looked at other cities and this is the best for this type of thing for the compensation. But I do think the way that the mayor has been kind of portraying this in the media, I personally, like from talking to renters that I know that they are under the impression that they are now protected if mm-hmm. there's just a, you know, renovation. And the truth of the matter is that they're not really any more protected. You know, they still have their rights. They still have their rights to go through the provincial system. The residential tenancy branch has been making these rulings that are much more sympathetic to tenants, holding landlords much more to account when it comes to saying, like, listen, you really don't have to have these people move due to this renovation. You can't evict them. But from the city's point of view, it's, and when it comes to rent evictions, they haven't really done anything more to protect tenants than what is there right now in the provincial system.
So you touched on this a little bit earlier, but following up to that, how does this policy then compare with what POCO and New West have in terms of protections for tenants facing a rent eviction?
Well, what I've heard from tenants in New Westminster, for instance, I talked to one woman who had been very, very stressed out about this repeated efforts from her landlord to, like, they put notices in her door all the time offering her like a buyout to move out because they were like, we're going to renovate your unit and evict you eventually. Why don't you take a few $1,000? And then she said, you know, after they passed that bylaw, I got a letter in the mail from, you know, a city staffer. And it said, you know, this is the bylaw we just passed. And this is what it says, that your landlord can't evict you to renovate. She's like, oh, my peace of mind was so much better. And now she's re-signed her lease with the same landlord. So, you know, I think we're going to have to watch and see what's going on in New West and Port Coquitlam. I think there might be some legal challenges. I think there is a concern that those cities might have impinged a little bit on provincial jurisdiction, and that's maybe the concern of Vancouver of why they didn't go that route. But I think we're just going to have to watch and see how these policies play out.
Well, thanks. Yeah. Thanks Thank again so much for taking the time to talk with us today. We really appreciate it, especially at the end of your work day.
Okay, great. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Jen.
Have a great day.
You too.
Okay, bye.
This piece was produced by Annie Ritter and Max Niemann. Thank you to Jensen Dennis and all the folks we spoke with at City Hall, especially Danny and Milo. Music by local band Skim Milk. You can find them on Bandcamp.
If you want to learn more about the new policy, and there's so much more to it, you can read the staff report on the City of Vancouver website under City Council, Meetings and Decisions, from Council on June 11th.
All right, and we're back. You are listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We just heard a piece by Annie Ritter and Max Niemann. So thank you very much, guys, for that report on the new renters' rights motion that passed at City Hall. We are a bit over time now, so we're going to sign out. Thanks very much for listening. Tune in again next Thursday at 5 p.m. Check out our podcast, Seeking Office. We're going to put up the renter motion on there. So if you missed it, you can hear it there. Yeah, so thanks for listening. Thanks to everyone who contributed. Take care. And up next is the Spencer Latu Show.